Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Research shows that the driving motivation for Indigenous people to support this is they believe that this is a unifying moment. And that is true to our culture. We are a sharing, collective culture, and that is why I think the Uluru Statement was endorsed so emphatically, you know, that it invites the Australian people to share who we are.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
Well, this episode is something of an explainer of a beautifully wild idea, at least in my opinion, the Indigenous Voice to Parliament. And my guest today is Thomas Mayo, a truly remarkable man in his own right. He's one of the most beautifully wild voices on the spirit and the handheld out invite that is The Voice. And I've asked him to join us during one of his trips in from Darwin to explain, well, it all. Now, I know there are still many of you out there who are a bit unsure of what The Voice actually is, or perhaps what it is not. Now, top line, and of course we'll get into it further in this episode, in about October or November this year, there will be a referendum, which is a vote whereby every Australian of voting age must decide if a change to the Constitution should be enacted. These referendums happen very, very rarely in Australia. There's only been 44. And they're designed with a lot of safeguards in place to ensure it's really, really, really wanted by the people. It requires a majority of the people in a majority of the states and a majority of the people overall. So it's a double majority. So far, only 8 referendums have got up in Australia's history, one of which, of course, was the change to the Constitution to give First Nations people the vote in 1967. So in this historic referendum, we will be voting on whether we agree to the idea, the overall principle, of altering the Constitution to very belatedly recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing a voice. That's it. It's pretty simple. Now, this voice will be a representative body that will advise Parliament and advise only, and only on matters that directly affect First Nations people. So, yes, it's a very modest change, and in many ways, it's a symbolic one. That said, this modest symbolic move has also been shown to work. It just works. It works around the world. When Indigenous people are consulted on issues that affect their people, you get better outcomes. And in a country where the gap between First Nations people and the rest of Australia is getting bigger, and when nothing else has worked to close the gap for decades in spite of all kinds of efforts, and we are the only colonised nation in the world that does not have a provision in the Constitution like this, you could say it's something that just needs to be done. It's time. It's important to know that extraordinary care and work, decades in fact, has been put into devising the voice as a solution. It is one of 3 proposals that emerged from the Uluru Statement from the Heart in 2016. These 3 proposals are a voice to Parliament, a Makarrata or agreement process, and a treaty. The Uluru Statement itself took years of deep consultation with Indigenous communities and elders around the country. Okay, so to my guest, Thomas Mayo is a Coorong Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander man raised in Darwin. At 17, he became a wharf labourer, and he is now an official of the Maritime Union of Australia, chairperson of the Northern Territory Indigenous Labour Network. He advises the Diversity Council of Australia. He's a signatory to the historical Uluru Statement, and he is one of the advocates for The Voice. He was also chosen to travel throughout Australia for 18 months with the Uluru Statement. And yes, it is actually a physical statement and a beautiful thing to see, taking it to the smallest of communities, to large civic gatherings, basically educating Australians on this whole thing. His patient, kind commitment to educating Australia on this movement is profound, and you'll get a sense of this in a moment. In his spare time, he's written 5 books for adults and children on race, fatherhood, the Uluru Statement, and his latest book, which he wrote with ABC veteran Kerry O'Brien, is called The Voice to Parliament Handbook, and it comes out this month. This episode is a really important one to me, and I've done it so that you can best follow the conversation in readiness for your vote, and so that you can share it with friends and family in the months leading up to the referendum, which, as I say, will occur in October or November this year. I've also designed it so that overseas listeners can get an understanding of this history-making event that's taking place. In the show notes, I will put a link to the Uluru Statement, also to the question that we're going to be asked at the referendum, and a whole bunch of other resources. So make sure you check it out. But let's now get to the interview. Thomas, welcome to Wild. It's wonderful to have you here in my sort of makeshift studio, my study here.
Thank you, Sarah. Good to be here with you.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. We've tried to organise a conversation about this for a couple of years now, but I think this is the perfect time.
It really is, yeah. It's all coming to a head. We've got a question, we've got the words. Peter Dutton has come out with a position against it, and
we now know where he stands. Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment.
That's handy.
Yeah, but look, I've been intrigued. I've followed your story. I follow you on Instagram, and I've followed you from sort of pre-election, your trade union stuff. It's really an interesting story, but you're essentially a quiet Torres Strait Islander kid, or at least that's how you started out. And I know you were quite reserved and shy, but you had a teacher, I think it was in year 11, an English teacher, who told you that be a great writer, you should be a writer, but instead you became a wharfie at the age of 17. You had kids pretty young. But along the way, you learned to be a person, a man in this country who speaks up on behalf of others. How and why did that happen?
Well, it really was through the trade union movement, you know, being a member of the union, the Maritime Union of Australia, on the wharves. Being on the wharves in the 1998 Patrick's dispute, I was only 20 years old when all that went down, and feeling that, you know, with 2 babies, feeling that great job that I had, and, you know, good wages, good conditions, a job that I enjoyed, was suddenly taken away from me in the middle of the night. There's a really interesting thing to think about here with what happened under Howard and trying to silence the voice of maritime workers, because that happened in 1998, and the goal that they had was to destroy the Maritime Union of Australia, a strong union with an important part in the logistics chain. Because you see, unions, the reason why they were respected and should be respected is because unions have done so much that workers and the general public take for granted. Universal healthcare, for example, you know, the Medicare system is something that unions negotiated and achieved, you know, with a lot of hard work and sacrifice. The superannuation system is something, again, that wasn't just given to workers, wasn't just given to Australians. It came from struggle, from workers uniting. And so Howard's strategy was to silence the MUA and then go after the rest of the union movement. And he failed with the MUA. And I think he followed through with his plan anyway with the work choices legislation.
Yes.
That was a stretch too far. And for a lot of Australians that were seeing their grandchildren, for example, being treated terribly at work, you know, not even being able to share what their conditions were at work, you know, their arrangements, for fear of breaking the law in doing that, they said, you've gone too far now. And so, but there's something here that we'll come back to the voice later if you like. But
yeah, we certainly will. Yeah.
But the tactic, this was something that was by design, and it was to soften up the Australian public before they moved in the mercenaries onto the wharves.
And you're seeing a replication of that. But we'll get to that in a moment. One other thing that you have spoken out on and really quite beautifully is on masculinity, and especially, you know, about First Nations men. And you've got an incredible book called Dear Son that came out a couple of years ago, where you get Indigenous men to write letters to their sons or their fathers. You've said that Black men have very much been demonised in this country, and that, you know, and I really do notice there's sort of a floodlight on Black men in our culture, unless they're throwing a football around a field. But then, of course, they're under the spotlight as well, aren't they? You know, if they do something wrong, the racist slurs come out. And shame is a really big theme, I think, and that's something that I know you've written about for Black men in this country. What have you had to overcome to be where you are now as a father of five kids, I think it is, and a spokesperson and a mentor?
Yeah, five children. There's a stereotype, and it's the reason why I wrote the book. There is a stereotype about Indigenous men that comes from several different things. Firstly, when I was, I'm 45, in my time in school, we were basically taught that my forefathers, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander forefathers, were savages and unintelligent, and that the colonialists that came and colonized this country were our saviors. And while, you know, the non-Indigenous children, the white children in the school were taught that their forefathers were, you know, explorers and scientists and our saviours. There's also the way that the Northern Territory intervention in 2007, it was John Howard, he basically announced to the entire nation that the social ills in our communities, in those remote communities in the Northern Territory, were an Aboriginal problem. That deserved,
not a systemic problem,
not something that was a result of traumas from colonization, forced assimilation, stolen generations, and a loss of hope as well in communities, failed policies and harmful laws, but announced to the entire nation that child abuse and those ills in those communities were an Aboriginal problem that deserved the Racial Discrimination Act being suspended to do what he did. Non-Indigenous people in that time, and you know, Johnny Little writes about it. He's from Central Australia. He's an Arrernte man. And he talks about how he observed when non-Indigenous people seeing an Aboriginal man with their child looking at them with suspicious eyes, as if that child needed protection from him because of, you know, who he was, because of their culture and heritage. And then lastly, the other driving force, you know, that causes this stereotype is things in the media, like the Bill Leak cartoons. Back in 2005, I think it was, or the Bill Leak cartoons that, you know, just the example is the one that depicts an Aboriginal man, you know, as a father, a policeman holding a Black boy by the scruff of the neck and saying to the Aboriginal man, "You need to take responsibility for your children." And the Aboriginal man saying, "All right, what's his name then?" You know, as if he didn't even know his son's name. And he's holding a can, you know, can of beer. Just, you know, blatantly racist cartoons like that.
Yeah. There's been a number of those over the years, cartoons like that. And we're all meant to laugh along with it, aren't we? Because that's the Australian way. You don't have a sense of humour. I think the other thing that happens with Indigenous men is that you've got, you know, Indigenous women in some ways have maintained their role as mothers, and Indigenous men in terms of having their role in the community, it's been very much watered down by shame, by not having employment opportunities, you know, often in these remote localities. And I think that's had quite a bit to do with the disenfranchisement of Indigenous men, and we don't have a discussion around it as much as we do around the plight of Indigenous women. It's often left behind somewhat.
Yeah, it's a purposeful thing, because when you take away, you know, the family unit and the community unit, when you take away the pride that Indigenous men have in what they contribute to the community and to a family, you open the family up for exploitation. You open the land up for exploitation.
Yeah.
And it's been a purposeful thing. The book at the same time, you know, I call it an act of defiance to celebrate who we are as First Nations men. But it also, at the same time, you know, the men were generous to write letters to their sons in this book, but we also acknowledge that gender violence and those behaviours like toxic masculinity, you know, these things are men, right?
Mm, they're
real.
And
we need to change our culture.
Yeah.
And we need to change the way that we treat women and other genders. And it's for us to call that out as well. And it's okay to be vulnerable. Mm. I wrote poetry in the book, you know, to sort of demonstrate that to young men and to also to soften it up between the letters, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I know it was received really well. And we can have both discussions, you know, about the work that needs to be done in Indigenous communities amongst the men to address these issues. And we can also have the conversation about assisting and supporting Indigenous men to get to a point of feeling well love for themselves, you know?
Yeah, and that's got to be good for our communities and our families.
Mm, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, look, let's move on to The Voice. It's an issue that's close to my heart. I'm very moved by the movement. I need to declare that up front. But I want you to imagine, and it's very hard for you because you've done so many interviews as a representative of all of this, an incredibly erudite speaker on it, but I'd like you to imagine that you're explaining it to somebody from overseas who really doesn't have that much background on the Indigenous situation here, nor The Voice itself. How would you explain it to them if you were down at the pub tonight? How would you explain what this voice business is?
Well, firstly, the present situation is that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have a life expectancy of almost 10 years less than other Australians. And in the world, proportionately, Indigenous people in this country are the most incarcerated people on the planet. There is a massive gap in many other measures about education and employment. Children are still being taken from their families and their culture.
And if I can just add to that, because I, as you know, Thomas, I foster Indigenous kids, which is contentious, you know, and I'm very aware of that, but it's in very imperfect situation. But there are around about 42,000 foster kids in Australia, and a little over half are Indigenous.
Mm.
And there's a whole range of reasons, of course, for that, but that's another one of the pillars of the closing the gap issue that Australia's been trying to address now for over a decade. But, yes, please continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are all these obvious measures that show that there's a great gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And it is because of the way that colonisation happened in this country, and it's because it's what was described, W.E. Stanner gave a lecture in the Boyer Lectures, but it's the Great Australian Silence. Basically, that Indigenous people were here has been ignored, and we have refused to have this conversation amongst ourselves as Australians for a very long time. And to justify colonisation, you know, this country has had to do that. To justify the dispossession, Australia has had to do that. And so what we're talking about with The Voice here is that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been excluded from the founding document of this country, the Constitution, since Federation in 1901. And Indigenous people had an opportunity in 2017 to come together and set the priority that we would propose to the rest of the country. And we proposed a voice so that we can be heard, and that is a form of recognition that we exist, which doesn't happen right now.
Yeah, and this was something that came about after extensive consultations with elders and communities around the country, right? Like, it wasn't just a couple of people in a boardroom going, hey, how about we try this? This has been an ongoing conversation. Nothing else has worked. That's where we're at. Everything that has been tried so far has not worked. That closing the gap idea, you know, and the gap being the gap between white Australia and the First Nations people, in most of those, I think, is it 17 factors, the gap has enlarged.
Hmm.
It has not closed. So we've got to do something. And so from what I understand, The Voice came about as a measure that could address this?
Yeah, so I would say to that person not from Australia that Indigenous people have struggled through all this time to be heard. We have stood up like any other human group would do. We had frontier wars when, you know, colonization was spreading across the country. We have established representative bodies to speak on our behalf in a coherent and informed way. We have strived with protests and other actions to change the direction of this country so that it would embrace who we are as Indigenous people and respect who we are as Indigenous people and include us in the politics and the decision-making of this country in a proper way.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The Uluru Statement from the Heart was a document, a beautiful kind of statement that was put together, and the idea of the voice came out of that. It was one of three invitations to Australia that was proposed. So, so that people know the background.
Yeah. And so with this struggle, one of the things that happened was in 2015, as the gap was widening in all these measures, in that crisis, 39 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders from around the country proposed a meeting with the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. And that meeting happened in Kirribilli House, and the Kirribilli Statement was made. And it said two things. Firstly, it said in regards to constitutional recognition, we want a substantive form of constitutional recognition, not just symbolic, something that gives greater fairness to our people. And secondly, we want a referendum council established to take the question back to our communities about how we wanted to be empowered, how we wanted to be recognised, and to the broader Australian public. So the referendum council was established. It ran 13 regional dialogues. It was led by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And those dialogues chose delegates that came together in the heart of the country at Uluru. And that is where the Uluru Statement was made, which proposed a constitutionally enshrined voice to Parliament and a Makarrata Commission to do truth-telling and agreement-making.
A Makarrata is essentially a truth-telling or truth-accepting process, right?
Yeah, it's a dispute resolution process, basically, an ancient dispute resolution process that comes from the Yolngu people in northeast Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory. And I'm sure that all of the First Nations in Australia had a similar word and process as Makarrata. Mm. And I say that because in this country, on this continent, we have hundreds of unique First Nations languages. And I'm not talking about different dialects here. I'm talking unique languages. And it indicates, as experts say, that we were masters of dispute resolution. How else could these languages have evolved? And we must have understood what country we belong to, not so much about possessing and exploiting country, but what country we cared for. Mm. And it says a lot about our culture as to go back to what I was saying about what we were taught in school, that we weren't savages and we weren't unintelligent. Mm. We had an advanced culture and civilization.
And sophisticated processes for living together on a very harsh land back then. So, yeah, just to clear things up, there was the Uluru Statement from the Heart that you know, came about after a long process of official and also regional collaborative discussions. I mean, extensive work was put into it. Then the Uluru Statement was read out, and from that, three suggestions were made: to have a voice to Parliament enshrined in the Constitution, and this is what we're going to talk about in a moment, a Makarrata and treaty. And out of all of that, the next step that came about was the decision was made to go ahead with the voice, not at the exclusion of Makarrata and treaty, but as a let's just get this thing done. And so that a lot of emphasis has been put on that. So that's what is going to be put to the Australian people at a referendum. Every Australian will have to vote. And correct me if I'm wrong, we're looking at October, November timing. It'll be by the end of this year. And we are going to be asked a very simple question, and it's in keeping with how all changes to the Constitution come about. So a referendum only happens when we need to make a change to the Constitution. 44 have been put to the Australian people, only 8 have got passed, because it's a very high bar for it to pass. It's a majority of votes in a majority of states to succeed.
And a majority overall.
And it's a double majority, you're right. So and then a majority overall. So it's a hard standard, but it's been done before, and it happens quite beautifully. It happens elegantly. It happens when we really are ready for it. And I personally believe this is going to be one such referendum. So I just want to put that in context. So what we're really talking about with the voice is one of the three proposals, invitations, and it's the one that needs to go to a referendum because it entails changing the Constitution. And there's a number of things there that I want to touch on in a moment. But could you actually outline sort of the limited but really quite defined things that this voice will do? So if we vote yes and we change the Constitution, what will it actually put into the Constitution?
Well, it's very much as the question says. The question is basically, do you agree in recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, the first peoples, to establish an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice? What the referendum is asking us is if we agree with the principle that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people should have a say before decisions are made about them.
About them. There's two things I want to pick up from on that. First of all is you're not going to be having a voice and a take on everything, like parking meters and, I don't know, whatever it might be. It's on the issues that are fundamentally affecting, you know, First Nations people.
That's what representative bodies do. They only have so much time and capacity.
That's it.
The Maritime Union doesn't comment on, you know, what plumbers do, for example. The Metals Industry Association, for example, doesn't talk about nursing, right? Mm.
So that's the first thing. The other thing that you mentioned in that explanation is that we're voting on the principle. So this is something that I'm going to drill down into a lot, because criticisms from the no camp, you know, and there's a significant no camp emerging that I think we just need to be aware of, really stem from this idea of focusing on a whole range of things that are irrelevant. Because I just want to really emphasize to listeners, what we're voting on is a principle. So it's the idea of Indigenous peoples having a say in issues affecting them, because, and I'm going to jump to the next point here because it's really relevant and required, it has been shown that when First Nations people do have input into decisions affecting them, the outcomes are way, way better. I just want to stall on that for a little moment, Thomas. That has been established, hasn't it? There's been a number of studies, a lot of research to show that what we're talking about here works.
Yeah, absolutely. Examples are how COVID was handled in communities.
Right.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, through Ken White, the minister at the time, had some agency over that. We saw results, you know, or the protection of those communities and very low numbers of infection and fatalities, because Indigenous people in those communities controlled how we handled COVID. Another example is Koori courts, where elders are involved in the justice system and the hearings. You see much lower rates of recidivism and those types of things. Also, Aboriginal birthing programs where, you know, cultural birth processes and methods are used, and you see much lower rates of infant mortality. These are examples of just how important it is to listen to Indigenous people. There are common issues across all of our communities that a voice would influence and guide the government on. Mm. Housing is a common issue across all of our communities. The justice system is an issue for Indigenous people across the country. The way that programs are run, you know, where funding goes to. There's many things for the voice to engage in that our people will expect the voice to engage with. It's not going to engage with, you know, as we mentioned before,
parking
and as was mentioned, the RBA, you know, and interest rates.
Yeah.
And like Indigenous people will expect that we tackle those issues that are most important to us on the ground.
Yeah. So there's just a couple more things I want to get you to explain as to what the voice is before we move on to what it isn't. I did a bit of a call out and somebody actually asked, it was Blair Stafford on Instagram, who decides the makeup of the representatives of the voice? So that's something that I think is a detail that has been set out. Could you answer that one and also give us a feel for some of the other details that have been established already in what we know going into this referendum?
Yeah, it'll be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that choose representatives. Those representatives will have a set term for accountability. And the way that people will be chosen and the regions that they'll be chosen from or electorates are going to be negotiated with Aboriginal communities. They're going to be consulted after the referendum.
Which is the appropriate way. I'm just going to keep coming back to
this.
We are voting on the principle.
Exactly.
The broad-based, almost ethical and moral principle.
That's right.
Of the idea of they should be recognised as the First Nations people and should have a voice on things that are affecting them and in a dastardly way. So these kinds of details, they're yet to come. And I'm going to throw in here, this is going to be something that the Parliament decides. So it's not going to be Aboriginal people determining all of these details. The details will be determined by the Australian Parliament, so it means the Liberal Party, the Nats, everybody who's been elected by all Australians.
Yeah, with Indigenous people.
Yep.
So with the establishment of that principle that Indigenous people should be heard, in the establishment of the model, they would negotiate and consult with Indigenous people.
That's it.
And,
but they'll be consulting, and I'm going to stop you again because that's another thing that this debate gets stalled on, is that the Indigenous people will be consulting to various MPs, to the Parliament of the day, but they don't have veto power.
Absolutely.
The Parliament will be making final decisions. Of course, there's going to be a fairly strong imperative to listen, you know, and take on board the advice, but they don't have to because that's the way Parliament and the Constitution work together.
Yeah, I mean, the provision that was announced on the 23rd of March that will be going to debate in the Parliament that will most likely be going to the referendum is quite simple. In recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the First Peoples, there shall be an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice may make representations to the Parliament and Executive Government.
About
on matters that relate to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And the Parliament decides all matters about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice, including the composition, powers, functions and procedures. And this is the way that our Constitution works. We set up the principle, as we keep saying, the principle that Indigenous people should have a say.
Yeah, we reckon this is a good idea.
That it's not a right to veto, you know, it can make representations. There's nothing about a right to veto or, you know, holding up the government processes. It's advice to the Parliament. The rest of it is decided by the Parliament because it needs to be flexible enough to improve over time. You don't want to
adjust to the
put
era.
How many representatives and how much funding and all that sort of thing in the Constitution and need to hold a referendum to see the organisation improve with the needs of the people.
Yeah. It's like if a country needs to set up an army, do in principle we agree we need an army? Yeah. You're not going to hold up the process while people bicker about the colour of the uniform. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've read the Constitution a number of times. It sets up that the Parliament has the power to collect taxes It doesn't say how they choose who the tax commissioner is.
What the tax rate's going to be.
How much tax they're going to collect. You know, those things need to be flexible.
And we need to vote on them as Australians.
That's right. And we hold out who we choose to represent us to account through the democracy.
So I'm going to keep emphasising this referendum, right, anything to do with the Constitution, we only get to vote on the vibe, you know, the broad concept. Yeah. This in principle matters to us and it should be in the Constitution.
Should the Parliament and the executive government that implements the policies listen to Indigenous people? Yes or no?
It's not unreasonable. This is the extraordinary thing. It's quite beautiful and I can't believe it's not already in the Constitution. And that's the point. Australia is an outlier in not having the First Nations people represented in its Constitution.
And that's what children say. Why haven't we granted Indigenous people this fairness
before? Is that
right?
Yeah, because you work with a lot of kids, don't you, on all of this and educating them on First Nations issues.
Yeah, I've got a children's book about the Uluru Statement, Finding Our Heart. And
I'll put a link in the show notes because I've seen it in bookshops everywhere. I recommend, and it's at, you know, my foster kid's school. I saw it in the principal's office. I recommend it as a starting point. If you're struggling with the basics of this, read the kid's book by Thomas.
Children, like they were drumming fairness into them all the time, right? They get it. You know, you should talk to people before you make decisions about them. And secondly, they have an innate understanding of what makes us unique as Australians.
Yeah. So a couple more rapid-fire questions that have come through on my Instagram feed. One person has asked, is this a third chamber of Parliament, yes or no?
No, absolutely not.
It's not even close, is it?
Like, okay. There's not much more
it's
to say.
It's an advisory body. Okay. Another person has actually asked, and I think this is a really interesting question, what is the basis of people's reticence, or what's the real basis of the no campaign? The person wrote to me and said, I just don't understand. I think I understand why we would want to say yes. And I think that's the intuitive impulse, right, of Australians. But then they hear that there's people opposing it, and they're trying to wonder why, like, have they missed a memo here?
I don't understand the people that are leading the no case, because unless it's driven purely by their own profile building and for their own career aspirations and whoever is backing them, I don't understand who's backing them. I do understand that it's organisations like the IPA and the CIS, right-wing think tanks, so I guess they have an ideological view of the world. That is very hard to understand. For other people, I think it boils down to fear.
And confusion,
and
surely.
Confusion.
Yeah.
And confusion, you know, the safest thing to do is say no. And that's where the no case has a bit of an easy task. They don't need to be consistent. They don't need to be truthful. They just need to create enough confusion so that people are afraid that they're doing the wrong thing if they vote yes. That is what drives people. To counter that, we need to keep it simple. Remember, it's the principle that we're enshrining. We need to explain to people that it is the right thing to do, that it is safe, that it's not a third chamber, it's not a right to veto, and it's just a decent and fair thing to do.
I don't think a memo has been missed for anybody who feels intuitively like this makes sense as a yes vote. It really is sort of, you know, in podcast land, Thomas, there's a phrase called just asking questions or jacking. And by jacking, you insert doubt and fear. It doesn't matter what question you ask, right? It actually just poses doubt and fear. And sometimes that's all you have to do if you're in opposition to something.
Yeah, and I asked the listeners to take notice of that pattern, you know, of them same questions coming over and over again and the answers given, but they keep asking them same questions.
Yeah.
It really is a strategic
approach.
It's a
tactic, a tactic of confusion, as you say. Okay, another question is, do you have a sense of the scale of people and organisations such as banks and insurance agencies, et cetera, who are supporting the yes vote?
I believe we have the ingredients for change here, and that is that there are many organisations from across the political spectrum that support this.
There's banks and so on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like from the biggest banks, the NAB, for example, have been great supporters, all of the top law firms.
Business Council of Australia?
Business Council of Australia, you know, on behalf of corporates, big supporters. The NGOs, Aboriginal controlled organisations, you know, the health bodies, peak bodies, all of those frontline service organisations have supported this, Fred Hollows, through to unions, you know, mm-hmm. and my union that has supported the work that I've done for the last 6 years. They've covered my salary, they've covered my travel and accommodation for six solid years.
While you work on this.
Just to work on this. And so it's from across the political spectrum. You know, organisations that are at loggerheads on many other matters are united in supporting this. And that's the ingredients for change, I think.
Mm. Okay. I've got one last question for you. I guess I've got to ask, what will The Voice bring to Australia, in your opinion, both to Indigenous Australia but also all Australians? Although I'm almost tempted to ask instead, perhaps we should flip it this way. It's more the inverse, I suppose. How will we as Australians feel if we wake up and the vote comes in as a no?
Well, I mean, every time I think about this, you know, there's all sorts of emotions. It's sadness that I feel. It's not even anger. I mean, it's sadness. And, you know, it brings a tear to the eye to think that imagine being a teacher, you know, or even just teaching your children that at this moment in time, in 2023, we said no to recognising the existence of the Indigenous peoples that have been connected to this place for over 65,000 years. And imagine saying to them that we said no collectively as Australians to the fairness of listening to those people.
Mm.
It would be just a horrible thing to wake up to, that we've failed in this. And I say to the listeners, don't just vote yes, but work hard as Indigenous people did to provide this invitation and this opportunity. Work as hard as we did to put your hand out like we did to other Australians and bring them along with us. It's unimaginable to be in a country that has officially said no to recognition and fairness.
Yeah, yeah. I think about the question a lot myself as well. It'd be a real stain on our character. And I think if we go flip it back to the positive, I also think, and I say this to people, imagine how proud we will feel if we wake up and the majority, you know, the double majority has said, yes, let's change this, let's fix this.
It's the greatest gift we could give to the following generations that we have achieved this in our time.
Yeah.
Like, what a great gift to, you know, future Australians that we have done this and we haven't left them that burden of an ignorance to our colonial past, you know, an ignorance to our Indigenous heritage and culture. You see, you think of the Constitution like this as well, not just the rule book, but it's like our DNA, you know. It's what constitutes us as Australians. So it is a genuine sharing of that heritage and culture when we get this vote up. And, you know, I want to wake up the following morning
with a resounding yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Air punch.
Mm. And it is a unifying moment. I mean, there'll be divisive tactics in the coming months, but we say that this is a unifying thing because it is. And here's something to leave listeners with to understand the place that Indigenous people are coming from. Research shows that the driving motivation for Indigenous people to support this is they believe that this is a unifying moment.
Yeah,
that this would be a unifying moment.
Mm.
And that is true to our culture. You know, we are a sharing collective culture. And that is why I think the Uluru Statement was endorsed so emphatically, you know, that it invites the Australian people to share who we are.
It's a beautiful opportunity. And you've explained it so well. Thank you so much, Thomas Mayo.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay, so as I say from the outset, I am a supporter of the Yes campaign, but I do think it's very important to listen to the other side in these kinds of debates. It's an important one. The other Indigenous voices predominantly dispute the ordering of the rollout of the three components that form the Uluru Statement, so the Makarrata, Treaty and The Voice. But I guess I'm personally satisfied with Thomas's answer to this. Nothing is stopping the rollout of the Makarrata or Treaty. In fact, they are
already rolling out in states and territories around Australia. But it makes sense to focus on the voice as well and right now because it can be done now. It can be done immediately. So it's not either or, and it's not this, then that. It's yes to all of it. As to the other questions that are coming out of the no camp, they really are moot points, in my opinion. They can, in the main, be answered by the literal wording of the referendum question itself. So, for example, no, the voice can't veto laws or enforce their recommendations because, as it says on the packet, it advises only. Parliament can choose to take it or leave the recommendation. Some of the other no arguments are answered by a basic understanding of what a referendum is and how a constitution works. So layers of detail can't and shouldn't be given in advance because it's not how it works. We are being asked a question of principle only. Do we think First Nations people should be recognised and be able to give advice on things that matter to them, that affect them? Yes or no? That's it. Parliament, elected by us in elections, and yes, they're members of the Liberal Party, the Nats, the Greens, Labor, in whatever mix is in power at the time, it decides the details. We will hope that, you know, Parliament will listen to First Nations suggestions on all of it, like on the makeup of the representatives. And at this stage, the Labor Party and various legal bodies are saying that they are sound suggestions. So there you go. Members of the Liberal Party know all of this and they've been reminded of it repeatedly. Plus, they've been included in dozens of advisory meetings on all kinds of details over the last decade. And let's not forget, they were in power for the past 10 years. So we're in a position to ask a lot of questions if they wanted to and needed to. So I'm going to say it straight. All of this, we need more details stuff. It's a tactic. And sadly, it's a very effective one. All that said, I do encourage everyone listening here to vote with their conscience. And perhaps if I can gently invite this, vote according to how you want to wake up on the day the tally comes in. How will you want it announced to the rest of the world what we have decided for our country? And I always think it is interesting to phrase things in this way because as Australians, we do get a sense of our identity when we see ourselves viewed through others' eyes. And finally, one last invite. I've been personally touched and inspired from the first time I heard the Uluru Statement from the Heart by the spiritual, or perhaps you might want to call it ethical, essence, and thinking through the ramifications of the whole movement. It's a gentle and patient invite. It's a hand-extended message. And I've not always been sure that white Australia deserves such compassion and patience from Indigenous people. But we have been gifted it. As I listened to this conversation with Thomas, I was struck by the way that he was so quick to clarify and gently that not all of the Liberal Party is against the voice. If you catch him speaking in the media, he never blames anyone or gets impatient. And it's the same with many of the advocates. And I think it might stem from the original intent, the vibe set out in the beautifully wild Uluru Statement. Australia and the world, I feel, will learn a lot from this campaign and the process about Indigenous systems, about systemic change, about a different way to do dialogue and negotiation, about creating a new future. Okay, we'll finish there. There are many, many links in the show notes for this one, including a link to the previous episode I did with Professor Megan Davis and also my interview with the head of the Ethics Centre, Simon Longstaff, who presents a very intriguing ethical reason for voting yes. Thanks for listening, everyone. It's a big one. Please do spread the word, share this episode around the place, and I'll be back with more wildness next episode.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.